You're listening to The Fifth Estate from the Wheeler Centre. In this week's episode, we'll hear from Mia Love, once a rising star of the Republican Party in the US and now a candid critic of the party, particularly on the issue of race. She joined us last week at the Wheeler Centre to speak with our host, Sally Warhaft.
I wore my spangles. I didn't have a star-spangled top, but...
I should have worn the stars.
Look, you've got the red shoes on, Mia, so yeah. I think we're rocking the stripes tonight. It's such a pleasure to have Mia Love here for her big Melbourne event here at the Wheeler Centre. Mia, of course, was the first black female Republican to be elected to Congress in Utah's 4th District. She was appointed to the House Financial Services Committee, which oversees the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. She lost her re-election campaign after drawing unwanted attention from the president and has been outspoken ever since. She's a former...
Tell me how you feel.
A former mayor and city councillor of Saratoga Springs, currently a non-resident senior fellow at the United States Studies Centre at Sydney University. So please, such a thrill to have you here. A welcome for Mia Love.
Thank you.
And it really is, it's a unique situation that we're able to have a conversation with somebody who has so recently been right in this administration that so many of us are completely perplexed about. Mm-hmm. So let's start with just your take on the State of the Union, how you think America is tracking.
Well, that's a big, big question. And there's so much I can say about that. But I do want to, first of all, just say thank you for... I've been here for about a day and a half now, and my kids have this obsession with Australians in Australia, and I am so pleased to go back to tell my daughter that they're just as kind and as hospitable as she imagined all of you would be. I have had several people, at least 10 people, apologize for the weather. I was just like, wow, I just can't believe it. So I just want to say thank you
tomorrow,
for being so kind and loving. And just great people. I can't wait to spend some time here and then come back.
Well, there is a mutual thing between Australians and Americans and the two countries. But also, I think it also goes both ways. We're perplexing to each other in interesting ways. So tell us.
So it's really interesting. Americans are perplexed too. You've got Democrats that have put themselves in one area, and it's all anti the White House, and then you've got Republicans that are in two different categories that they've put themselves in. One is they're going to protect the White House at all cost, and they're going to do everything they can and turn a blind eye to, you know, anything that they have disagreed with in the past, or even morally have disagreed with. And then you've got some that are saying, you know, I don't want this person representing my party, so I'm going to leave the party. I have made it my mission to actually remain in the party and say that I'm not going to allow any person to lead what my principles and my beliefs are. Instead, I'm going to hold the White House accountable to the fundamental beliefs of just even kindness and caring for others and respect. And even if you disagree, there is no reason to be disagreeable. And at least be an example to my children as the type of example you should be to not just your family, but to people who are watching you. I believe in our country and in this world, we have an obligation to care for those who cannot care for themselves. I believe that if we have the resources and the ability to care for a fellow neighbor, we should do that. I also believe that if somebody's doing something that is that goes against the thing that I believe has made the country that I love so great, then you have a responsibility to call it out.
Do you think that the damage that he's doing, both to America's standing in the world, but also to your institutions, are fixable?
I do. As long as people remember that, again, there's this third category. You have to hold someone accountable or they're going to continue to behave in a way that's unacceptable. I think that I'm going to be incredibly open, honest, and candid that politics in the United States is just that. The American people are feeling very left behind. So much infighting. There's so much. There isn't anyone really trying to get some policy done. One of the things that I worked on and am very passionate about is immigration reform. That is so far in the distance right now that there is no trust in government institutions. There is no trust in Congress. Something's going to have to shift because American people, they just don't trust anybody in Washington any longer. Perfect example in the 115th Congress that I belong to, or I was part of, we passed about 1,400, a little over 1,400 bills out of the House. And then, of course, the Senate is where bills go to die, but only 400 in the 116th Congress. So you can see really a slowdown in actually getting legislation done.
Talk about what it was actually like to work with Trump, because you did make a remark at one point that you were going quite okay working with him.
Well, you want to give someone the benefit of the doubt. I believe in giving people a chance. There are obviously some things that I really disagreed with as a mother with two young girls and a young son, that there were some things that were disturbing to me. You can remember the Access Hollywood tape and some of these other things that it didn't sit well with me. But when somebody takes office, you want them to be successful and you want to do everything you can to help them be successful. But it was, and I tried to do that even after some of the comments about the country that my parents came from. I publicly called him out for it because it was my moral responsibility to do that. And my integrity means more to me than protecting a person in one seat in the White House, right? So I felt like it was important to try and help. And I said, look, let me help you with this policy. Let me help you with immigration policy. And when you just hit a wall all the time and you're just not, you're not getting anywhere, it gets frustrating. But I felt like it was my responsibility to do everything I can to say, I can sleep well at night because I know that I was true to the things that I said and the things that I believe in.
Was it ever hard, though, to sleep where you just thought he just shouldn't be there? And I mean, the Access Hollywood tapes is a great example of that. It's this Teflon thing that he's had where any other candidate for president or sitting president with that kind of a tape coming up would be finished. And yet he's just seen off everything, it seems, until now. Right, he's having a very, very bad week.
It feels like it's been a bad year.
Yeah, well, but I mean, there was a vote last night.
Yes, yes.
There was, they voted last night in the House for a non-binding resolution expressing opposition to the what Trump's doing in Syria.
Yeah, pulling
against
the troops
Kurds
out of Syria,
and that was 354-60.
Yeah, and he lost his mind.
Yeah.
And it's just because you've got someone who I think is used to getting his way, and he demands 100% loyalty and doesn't necessarily feel like he has to give that back. I can't tell you how many times as a member of the House of Representatives, it was just, it's okay, we're going to just throw the House under the bus because it's a figure of speech. It's just because my seat and my being here is more important than anything else. I would just like to remind members of Congress, I mean, they would say to me all the time, well, we have to stand behind the president. We have to stand behind him. Last time I checked, it was Congress that actually wrote the laws, and it is the executive branch that signs them into law. So I kept saying, he has to stand behind me. Right? We're the ones that are pushing legislation. And so he's got to stand behind us and sign them into law and then execute those laws.
Defenders of Trump sometimes argue, don't you know, read his Twitter account and listen to the meltdowns and the rantings, but look at what he does. Mm-hmm. And it feels like, certainly internationally, until the intervention with pulling the troops out of Syria, that this is a change in his behaviour, and it's come at a time where he's got all the stress of impeachment, and this looks somewhat like a response to that. Does he seem to you the kind of person that could actually do something really dangerous?
Well, that's a good question, because I think it's completely unpredictable. So let's talk a little bit about what was brewing before all of that. You had a lot of Americans that were feeling like they were left behind in the previous administration, especially a lot of blue-collar workers. And there was a lot of, it's what I call the silent majority, people who weren't really showing up in the polls.
They're the quiet Australians.
So there was always something kind of brewing. And someone like me, I never felt like I was part of the previous or the current administration. I felt like that type of America didn't include me. There was a feeling that I didn't feel like somebody was speaking for me. So there was this idea that, we needed to, with the previous administration, that it was do everything for everyone, and try and in the back of your mind, the Republicans are saying, well, how are you going to pay for that? How does that work? Who's going to get taxed? So you had a lot of blue collar workers that were losing their jobs, factories were closing, that felt like nobody was really speaking to them. And then you get a president that talks about America first and is very nationalist, and he's like, I'm going to make sure our jobs come back and everything's going to be made in the USA, even though I had to remind him that we don't produce everything in the United States. We have to work with other people to get some. I mean, that's what's great about
the world.
Free trade, right, is that you can get products and goods and services at the best price possible, and that's how you help the poor, is to keep prices and services as low as possible. That's a different subject. But there was this silent majority that all of a sudden was like, okay, well, somebody is speaking for me and somebody's going to help me. And then it went beyond that. It went to it's their fault. Right? The previous administration gave everything to them, and the reason why you don't have a job, and the reason why you don't have this, which when I hear, go back to the place that you came from, I'm just, those are, all of a sudden, it creates this animosity. And I think it's the one biggest threat that United States face, and it's this I call it a civil war, really, between
it's that
Americans.
Divided.
It's really divided. It's further on the fringes. Everyone in the middle is either retired or out of office, right? I was the only Republican in the Congressional Black Caucus, and we had a friendship there that I think was really conducive to getting things done.
Tell us more about that. I wanted to ask you about the Black the caucus.
I was told not to join.
Republican.
Right. And of course, me being stubborn, I've always believed that leaders put themselves in uncomfortable places.
By your own party, you were told not to.
I was told by everyone. Right. Literally, everyone said they're not going to like you. It's not going to work. There was somebody, Alan West, who was from Florida, who had joined the caucus, and they didn't want him, so he quit. And so I always feel, and I always tell my children, it's funny how I run everything. When I was a mayor, I ran it like a household. And so I think that mothers have some sort of an idea of how to kind of keep some civility in the home. We've got to keep the pieces together. But I was told not to go. And I believe that in order for you to affect any change, you have to go to those places that you can make some changes. If you get away from it, then you're not going to be able to do that. So I joined the caucus, and I have to tell you that they became my brothers and sisters. I found a group of people who prayed for me when my brother was diagnosed with colon cancer. We started looking at what we can do together, and they started seeing me as their one member in the Republican caucus. So they're like, Mia, we can't vote for this tax bill, but can you get this in it? Can you get child tax credit in there? And can you get this in it? So they were still, I felt like I was still doing some good. And of course, there were times where I had Marsha Fudge, who I called my big sister. I've had Paul Ryan, who was like a big brother, and I have Marsha Fudge, Democrat, who was like a big sister. Mm. She would come to me and she's like, uh-uh, change that vote. I know you want to be with us, but that's not going to be good for you. Mm. That means something to you, right? When all of a sudden they're looking out for you. David Scott, a Democrat from Atlanta, went against his own, the own political DNC and wrote a check for my reelection campaign. And he says, I believe it's good for us to have people of color on both sides of the aisle. I will never forget that man or those people that showed me what it was really like to be true Americans and working together. Even though you come from two different sides, you can find common ground.
I mean, when you talk about it so warmly, and I can see
it. I feel like I'm getting emotional about it. It's gone.
Yeah, yeah.
It's gone. The political parties fray that. Mm. They break it up. And I have to be fair. It's both sides, right? You've got the political side of the Democrat Party. Really, anybody who stands up to the president, all of a sudden they get primaried, they get damaged, and they're ready to pick up those seats. Mm. So it creates this divide where you've got people who are further to the right and people who are further to the left. Mm. And people don't dare to stick up to the president or stick up to, because no one's going to have their back at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So you can, this is probably some of the stuff that you don't see in the media, but is very, there's a true, that's a tangible, let's say, it's something that people are afraid of, and there is no benefit except for, you know, being courageous. And to me, my integrity and being a mom was more important than a seat.
I want to talk a bit about you, because your track, you know, to winning this seat and getting into politics, it was an amazing one. You and when you lost, you were 20 votes short of being able to issue a recount.
Yeah.
20 votes out of 269,000 votes. So you lost in 2018 by 0.258%, which is, that's like an Olympic sprint margin of a loss. Mm-hmm. A seat that you'd won in this context is really important too, that Mia was representing the 4th District in Utah. Now, mm-hmm. Utah, which is in the western part of the U.S., it borders Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho, Arizona, tiny little bit of New Mexico. It's absolutely beautiful part of America.
It's got 5 national parks. Visit Utah. It's great. It's beautiful.
But it's culturally fascinating. So it's the only state where the majority of the population belong to one church, which is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church. It has the least income inequality in America, the lowest child poverty, highest birth rate, youngest population. It is one of the most conservative Republican states in the United States, yet has had same-sex marriage since 2013.
First female vote.
First female vote. It's 86% white. It's 1% black, 1.2% Indigenous Americans.
And that's statewide, right?
And that is statewide. So how did you end up doing this?
You know, it's so funny because I think some talk show hosts have actually said there is a unicorn that was like elected in the state of Utah. It's really interesting because all of the things that got me elected are all of the things that actually that worked against me in some ways. On one hand, here I am, a black female mother, ran a city, was a city council member, became a mayor. Just not something I said I wanted to do when I grow up. You know, this wasn't something
that I was
ready to go on Broadway, and you know, that's what I wanted to do. And then it was just really, it was a path that an opportunity came up for me to do something outside of myself. And I said, the best thing I could do is be an example to my children, teach them that the world doesn't revolve around them. It's one thing to say it. It's another thing to do it. And, you know, I have no regrets. But again, I'm going to be incredibly candid here. One is there isn't anything that makes I'm not going to use the word liberal because it means something different here, but there isn't anything that makes a Democrat more upset than a black Republican woman. and then you've got, of course, you've got traditionalists, right, in Utah.
Yes.
People who you talk about the income equality issues. There are a lot of women who choose to stay home. As a matter of fact, if you listen to some of the young girls, when you say, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? The majority of them will say, well, I want to be a mom. I want to do this. Where, you know, there isn't this idea that you could actually you could be a mother and do other things. You've got these gifts and talents that are meant to be used for the betterment of your society. I am really proud. I have to mention this. I am so proud that I'm raising a daughter who is in an aerospace engineering program at Utah State. And I think it's because she saw her mom go out and say, you know, I can use my gifts and talents to do something good. And so I'm so glad that she thought beyond some of those things and said, I'm going to use some of these talents. The other issue is the fact that there are traditional mothers that if they can't see themselves doing that, it's very difficult for them to send somebody else. The question I would get asked all the time are, what about the kids? Are the kids okay with this? Is your husband okay with this? I had to consciously take my husband to events with me so that he could just, as the patriarch, say, I'm okay with this. You should be okay with this too. Right?
So it is traditional.
It's still incredibly traditional. One of the other things is I felt like I always had to rise to the occasion. Where I have other colleagues that I got along with, but I had to do twice as much, to pass twice as many bills. And still I would get people say, well, what is she doing? I'm like, oh my gosh, I passed 8 bills in the House. My predecessor passed 1, and that was naming a post office in the 12 years he was there. It's just incredible. So, I mean, these are the things that I had to always just talk about. I was the person that actually passed a bill when you have the whole Me Too movement that came out. I realized that Congress had this, like, fund that would pay for members of Congress, pay people off so that they could be protected And the victims, they would pay the victims, and they had this fund out there. And so I had to put up a bill and say, why do I have to do this? But I passed the bill in the House and was signed into law to stop taxpayer obligations to perpetrators of sexual harassment. I couldn't believe that, but I had to go outside of my committee to do that. And yet they're like, so what was that bill again? And I'm like, look, I don't have time to explain all of this. We have other things to do. Mm-hmm. We got to move on. I mean, I've got to make sure that every moment I spend away from my kids actually means something. So twice as hard for me. I don't know why, but it's fine.
When Trump had that just atrocious outburst with the women, the black women or women of color from Congress, and his remarks about Haiti. How do you correspond that to your experience in Utah, which is so white, overwhelmingly white? You've been elected. Who is he playing to when he behaves like that, Trump? Well, I mean, it is racist. It's just, to my mind, there's no, this is no doubt that, that he is racist. So who is he playing to?
I think he's, again, he's got this base that have been angry, that it have felt like no one has paid attention to them. And some of them, he's almost given them permission to, what is the word that I want to use to express some of the feelings that they have suppressed? And then you've got the others that I've just kind of turned and said, you know, it doesn't, I'm going to ignore this because at the end of the day, this person's going to keep my factory open or he's going to keep these things done. And those are the people that are saying, well, the policies are good and, you know, there's unemployment that is a record low and he's doing, you know, he's a bully to North Korea. Gosh, I wish that he would actually save all of that energy towards the people that actually want to harm America and harm the world. But I think that's the base that he's playing to. And I can tell you, they, when it comes down to it, I still believe that the same way you see Republicans in the House of Representatives be very careful about how often they speak out, you're going to get a good group of people that are going to go to the ballot that are going to say, at the end of the day, who is going to keep food on the table? Who is actually going to have my back? And I would just like to, there's some false choices out there. I wish I could just go to the president and say, your job is to represent all Americans, those who like you and those who don't.
So you still have that within you to think that you wish you could say that, because I feel like if
I don't
I
think
was
it's going to go anywhere is the thing. I mean, I just don't.
You think he'll be reelected?
I do.
At the moment, yeah.
I do, because I think that there are people that care. There's still this there's this self-interest out there. Now, the reason why you've got Republicans that have spoken out about Syria is, one, I feel like they were trying to get something that they could say.
Well, and all right. Outright racism wasn't enough?
Well, you look at their districts and you say they're afraid that the president will go after them. Look at Mitt Romney, for instance, who talks about, who's a senator in the state of Utah, who has been outspoken about inappropriate conversations. He's getting reamed in the state of Utah and has gotten a lot of backlash from the president of the United States. Joe Biden, who is a former vice president, only recently called out for impeachment. So you've got, I mean, there's still the majority of Americans that the word impeachment, and they don't want people to see the United States as being racist. And I'm just trying to say that the United States isn't. You've got a president that is making these comments, and the way that you stand up and stand up for your principles is by saying, we don't believe in that. We're not okay with this. Doesn't mean that you just have to have enough courage to say this is not okay, and that's the only way that it's going to stop.
But then also to stop somebody like that from being reelected. I mean, I guess it depends how important racism is to you compared to other things, or sexism, or, you know, whatever your list is.
Yeah.
But I mean, what you're describing with Mitt Romney, with Biden, with people in the districts is that's a presidency of just tyranny, you know,
yeah.
where people are too. I think, you know, I've been befuddled about, you know, why the Kurds, but not. Children in refugee camps in the Mexican border who have been separated from their parents. Why was that? What when it becomes enough to just say no? And I mean, do you think impeachment? I mean, obviously, it's in the early investigative stages, and we need to see what comes out of it. But do you think if evidence was found that the Republicans would ever?
I think if evidence was found, it would just be the same issue as it was in Watergate. I think that there are times where and it's only because, and I'm being completely open and honest here, when they get to the point where they just can't defend it in their districts anymore, where it just, there are too many people there that are more concerned about their seats, and that's on both sides, right? More concerned about their seats than they are about getting things done. And the best example I can give of that is when I was a member of Congress, I was part of the Climate Solutions Caucus, telling people that you don't have to choose one or the other. You can actually have good energy production and save your environment too. You can actually just get your head out of the sand and stop pretending that this is not happening, right? That we're not doing some harm. So think about that. Our job was to recruit as many Republicans to kind of open up their eyes about this. We went from 10 to 42 Republicans. Now we're back to 7. Mm. All of those people were gone. They either retired or they lost their elections. So until there is a point where someone says, okay, this is not going to work anymore. There is evidence of a quid pro quo or a real crime and I think that the bar is set higher because the day after Donald Trump won election, the left has been calling for an impeachment. And I think that that actually didn't help with the cause because it's just been day after day after day. So now the bar is set higher. And you've got some people that are like, well, they've been looking for this. They've been trying to look for something. There's a lot of mistrust in the institutions also. I think one more thing that I think it's incredibly important to mention is that the process is a little different than previously. There has not been a vote held on the floor, and Republicans will not even look at it unless they're brought to the table. So all of this is being done by the Speaker of the House, Adam Schiff, and the Republicans have been completely shut out of the investigative process. Mm. So without that vote being on the floor, unlike Benghazi, there were people that were getting their sides and talking about, and it was open and transparent. And so I think that until that happens, you're not going to get, there hasn't been one Republican, not one. And I tell you, if they take a vote, there are a lot of people that are in swing districts that aren't willing to take that vote. Yeah.
It's such a tricky thing if you set out to join a political party. I'm sure there's never been a single politician that's taken that dive and there hasn't been some policy there that's been difficult for them.
All difficult.
it's part of it, isn't it? If you're going to be part of a party, you have to suck it up and there are going to be some issues you're going to have to pretend you agree with and you don't. And if people didn't hold the party line with most of the things most of the time, then it probably wouldn't function, although perhaps
this
it would.
This is probably why I'm not perhaps there anymore, because I've never been that person.
Right.
If I disagreed with somebody, I didn't care what the party said. I was just like, I disagree. Like, yeah. I tried to get contraceptives over the counter. I'm like, are you guys kidding me? I mean, you don't like the Affordable Care Act. So as a person who is pro-life, I felt the best way to give people some control over their body is by giving them the decision before they have to make a decision between keeping a life or ending a life,
yeah.
right? So that it's also one of those things that I'm like, let me carry this because I am a female. I know what I'm talking about. It's funny because the people that I had issues with were Republican men. It was just quite interesting. Mm. But those are the types of things that... And like I said, maybe that's why, because there were some things that I just would not stand by and take. And when I had an opinion about something, I was going to be open and honest about it.
There are some issues that are, I think for many Australians, not all, but the majority, it appears, are quite mystifying about America, about the issues that, you know, for example, in Australia... we don't have the death penalty. We haven't for decades. Mm-hmm. It never comes up as a serious. Major parties have always agreed since yeah. it's not going to be put on the table. I think abortion generally, there are still debates in state parliaments mm-hmm. and so on, but it's hard to imagine that being a federal issue in Australia ever, whether Australian women should have decisions or not over that. And gun control mm-hmm. is the other one. And it was our conservative, we say liberal, Prime Minister John Howard who brought in those controls. And, yeah. and I don't know whether anybody else could have done it. Yeah. He did it brilliantly. I mean, he was a divisive Prime Minister. But I think most Australians now look back, I think it was 96.
Yeah.
These are issues, and I think particularly gun control is one where Australians just look at them and we don't...
And everybody's in the same place.
We just
on
don't
that.
Understand how the debate could be whether or not you should be 18 or 21 to be able to walk into a shop and buy a semi-automatic weapon.
Yeah.
You know, that's the level of the debate.
So let me give you a perspective that maybe a little different. One of the things that I've had to learn is that I know what I know. My experiences, my environment really form what I believe in.
Was your first date at a gun range with your husband?
No, my first gift was actually a 22.
Okay.
My first gift. And my mom was like, who is this person? What are you doing?
I knew there was something.
No, but
let me explain
something. There was a point where I decided, this is the best way I can explain it. I decided that I was going to start oil painting. I had no idea between oil. I mean, I was just coming from my first campaign that was just horrible. And I just wanted to do something that I felt would make me feel zen. I don't know. So I went to Hobby Lobby. I grabbed some oils because it sounded cool. And I started painting. Now, there is this mountain. We live near these beautiful mountains. And there's this mountain near my home that I could see every day called Mount Timpanogos. And I painted. And I just started. I didn't draw. And it looked like Mount Timpanogos. And I'm like, wow, I'm really good at this. I was just like, I mean, it looked great. So I was just like, now for my next painting, I'm going to do an English countryside. And I started to paint. And you know what? It looked like the back of Mount Timpanogos. And I started saying, why can't I do this? And I realized that unless I really expose myself to, I started looking at pictures and looking at pictures and looking at pictures and trying to expose myself, I realized that the trees were different. The unplowed fields were different. And I really had to expose myself to those pictures in order to be able to paint that. I asked Cedric, who is the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, why are you a Democrat? Because I've always believed in bigger people, less government. So it doesn't make any sense to me why you would be a Democrat. And he said, well, I'm from a state where it was actually the federal government that gave us our civil rights and that the states were actually. So it's not until you open your mind that you start getting a different perspective. So when it comes to firearms or the Second Amendment, people, there are people that grew up, they grew up on farms, they grew up hunting, and the word of gun control is something that is fundamental to them, where you're like, if you start taking away my Second Amendment constitutional rights, that's a slippery slope. And so they can't, it's hard to do that. And unless you're from those areas, I mean, Paul Ryan would say that he grew up, you know, shooting with his dad, hunting. He's a big hunter.
Yeah, I mean, but and also, I mean, and in so the time that was written, though, hunting rifles were not semi-automatic.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even know what the word is, weapons.
So I took a manual cleaver. And again, this is just, it's about what is actually going to make a difference. What laws will actually stop these hideous crimes from happening? I come from a place where the high school right next to me, there's 6 suicides in 1 year in one high school. There's something that you have to, my daughter would say best, she's like, I wish you guys would focus on stopping the violent thought before I become a victim of the violent act. I took Emmanuel Cleaver right after there was this debate on the floor where people were protesting on the floor on gun control. And Emmanuel Cleaver, who is a Democrat, came to my district with me, and I took him up to, we have some acres up in a property, and we have these black bears there. And in the car, we had a 9mm. I'm not a big hunter, but my husband is a big hunter. Grew up with a father that was a big hunter. And he had a rifle on the other hand. And I said, now when you go up here, there are a lot of black bears. The 9mm will not do a thing. If you get yourself between a, we have our dog with us, so we never have to use, you know, anything. But I said, a 9mm won't stop. As a matter of fact, their skull is about an inch thick. I said, whatever makes you feel comfortable. And he's just like, do what you have to do. The next time we went to the Congressional Black Caucus and they were talking about that, he's like, you know what? Some of the things that are going on in the inner city is different than we, unless we keep in mind some of these other districts where we can speak to them, we're never going to have anything meaningful on gun control. So it wasn't until he came into that environment and I went into his. If we actually did that, you would see some good, meaningful conversation. Right now, everyone is completely closed off. And when you've got more of the fringes, people are trying to protect. The right is trying to protect as much as they can, and the left is trying to hold firm. There is no meeting in the middle.
It is this whole topic is just, I feel like I'm on another planet when I hear about it. But it's obviously a really big one. Yet again, I heard then when you talk about that black caucus, that there's something changes in you when you talk about it. And I want to get it back to that for a moment, because we started talking about the division, mm-hmm. you know, in politics in America. It's here as well. There are some close friendships, not, I don't think as many as there used to be, mm-hmm. across the aisles in Australian politics. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of hatred. You know, there's just a lot of, and some of it, and you hear it in, you know, American politics too, that just a sort of a loathing, a complete inability to understand people. Reaching across, and it seems to be getting worse.
Yeah.
How? What are other ways that it can be bridged? I mean, that caucus sounds to me like the place where you experience the most truth.
I'm not upset about losing an election, because I love. I mean, I felt like I did the best that I possibly can, and I was I was honest about my beliefs and about my thoughts. And I didn't just say things just to say things. And so I feel good with that. I feel like I can sleep well at night, and I could face my children and they can say, you know, mom did exactly what she set out to do.
What I am
upset about is the area that we've lost, where there was that type of, we're going to put politics aside. Not one member of the Congressional Black Caucus came after me. Even those that were completely on different ends of the aisle said, we are not touching her. And went to their party and said, we'll go after anybody, but we're not touching her. I think that that's the part that I am most sad about, because it was the most unlikely friendships and connection. And I don't know if we're going to see that again. I'm an optimist. I do. I believe that people are inherently good. I do. I believe that. It's why you saw, you know, the things that we saw on 9/11. It was a horrible day for Americans, but it was also one of the best, most inspiring day for Americans and the world, because not only Republicans and Democrats got together, but the entire world got together and said, terrorism is not, we're going to fight terrorism. It was one of the most beautiful days. And I feel like we're losing some of that. People are completely, they don't remember what they're there for. And no one is courageous enough to say, I'm willing to stand up for what's right, even if it means that I'm not going to be there any longer. Will I ever run again? I don't know. Maybe not. If I feel like there is an opportunity for me to do some good, but I love being here. I love being unleashed and unshackled. And I mean, I've never cared what the president or anybody said about me. And I actually think it would have been better off for him if I actually won the election. Mm. I mean, because it's like, there is nothing. I mean, I wasn't afraid then. I mean, now it's like, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid of him. I mean, I just, you know, I will say when there's something, I'm looking for any bit of light or anything that I can shed light on and say, okay, this is good, you know? But I'm obviously going to call it out when I see it.
Could you vote for him?
That's a tough question. Let's put it this way. I was not, hang on a second, I didn't vote for him before. So,
yeah, true.
So if you can imagine, you know,
and the election first,
and I told him that too. I was just like, I actually wrote in a name. So, I think like me, there are so many people, morally, it's something that is, I can't explain that. Right? I couldn't explain that vote. But then policy-wise, there isn't anything there's nobody else out there. Mm. Because policy-wise, I'm in no man's land. And I think that there are a lot of people that feel that way, that they're just in, there isn't anyone that is really willing to look outside of themselves and look at what's best for somebody else.
I know that, I've read, if it's true, that you really considered voting for Obama. And I think your father did vote for Obama. He's a real swinging voter, right? He's Reagan.
It's really interesting. My dad, his first vote was for Ronald Reagan. Mm. And so you have to understand, he came from a country where it was one dictator after another dictator after another dictator. And so he was just inherently less federal government, more local governments. And he actually didn't. My parents didn't vote for President Obama either. Okay. They felt like it was more important for them to vote on the substance than it is to vote for somebody or against somebody because of the color of their skin. Mm. My parents have been a great example to me in terms of look at the content of someone's character, which is why I am not a person that have been able to go along to get along. I'm kind of a little bit of a troublemaker because I'm not a go along to get along person. Mm. That's been a problem for some people in the party. They're like, I wish you would just accept some of these things, and I just won't do it.
So do you think the Republican Party can hold itself together over the next 12 months?
Only
what do you think?
If they stand up and stand strong, because what you're going to get is if you follow a person, people will let you down. And I don't think that the president is doing us any favors. I really don't. people will let you down. Well, your principles will not. The platform that you believe in, if you hold people accountable to that, you don't have to lose your party. And two parties are good for democracy. And I will say this. Remember this. Being in the Congressional Black Caucus, I believe, was an example of true democracy, where people come together and they talk about what they're for, instead of focusing on what they're against.
We have this thing in Australia that, I mean, you will just hate this, but...
Oh, gosh.
I think it holds our country kind of together, actually. And it's compulsory voting.
I don't know there is anything that you could say that would actually make me hate Australia.
No. I wouldn't think it would make me hate Australia, but it would go against your... political instincts of freedom, you know, for the... And, I mean, I've always said it's not compulsory voting, it's compulsory ticking off your name. And, of course, then you can do whatever you want in that private ballot booth. It tends to keep Australian political debate more to the centre than places where you have to fight to get that vote. And perhaps... can bring, I mean, you know, we've got divisions here too that are nasty and new and relatively new. But what other things can be done to bring people across the aisles a bit more from your experience within it? What can be done?
One is, do not let perfect be the enemy of a really good win. There are way too many times where it's like, I want all of it, and what you end up is getting nothing.
Well, the Greens had an example of that with climate change policy in Australia some years ago.
I think that one of the things that I've pushed for, that both the left and the right, people, not politicians, but people have been for, have been a bill that I introduced every single year. It's easy in its ideas and its practicality. It's more difficult in getting people to do that because they, and that is one subject at a time. And that is, every bill enacted by Congress really should be limited to one subject, and that subject should be clearly stated in the title. I can't tell you how frustrated people are when their representative votes for something that they swore they would never vote for because it's attached to something that they promised that they would vote for. It's a way to get to, I think every bill should either stand on its own or fail on its own. I think if you start doing that, you start getting a little bit more of the of honesty, transparency. You get a little bit more work out of members of Congress. Any bill that is way too comprehensive, there's always deal breakers, which if you can see throughout the world, I mean, you can look as far as, you know, Brexit and what's going on there. When you've got big bills, there's always a deal breaker somewhere in there for somebody. And they're like, well, I can't vote for that. Sorry. That one issue was my deal breaker. That issue was my deal breaker. The other thing that I think, which is the most important, way too much power is consolidated in one branch of government, and that's the executive branch. Congress has given up their power, given up their ability, and it's only because they didn't want to be held accountable. Part of the responsibilities you have as a legislator is taking the blame for some wrong decisions. They don't want to do that. They want to be able to say, well, it's that person's fault or that person's fault, right? They want to give it to another branch, I call it the fourth branch of government, that aren't elected by people or accountable to people. And I think that that's been to the detriment of the American people. Congress just saying, I don't want to take responsibility for this, and they've just delegated their power away.
Which
and now the executive branch is too powerful.
Yeah. Which decisions come to mind when you say that?
So I can look as recently as, for instance, Dodd-Frank. I was on financial services where there was a financial crisis and they wanted to stop this too big to fail banks. Mm. And they created all of this legislation. The best way I can describe it is when you have a kid that's sick, we call it Tylenol. Do you guys have Tylenol here? Yeah, okay. So we have this kid that's sick. Instead of giving them the right dose and the right type of legislation, it's almost like they poured the entire bottle of Tylenol. And it ended up, we had this crisis where we were creating the one thing that we didn't want to create, which is small banks were closing at a rate of one per day. These are the banks that were in people's communities, farmers can go to, and they were being absorbed by bigger banks or just going away. So you were having all of this, the financial institutions consolidated into one area. And if that one bank fails, then the economy just goes kaput. And it created the CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. It created all of these other institutions that aren't elected by Congress. And they were doing all of the rules and the regulations and all of these other things, and people felt like they had no voice. That's an example of that, where they should have sat down and come up with the ideas themselves. It's just because Congress said, I don't want to be responsible for any other financial crisis, so I'm going to create an institution that will take the responsibility for it. This is like really in the, you know, it's really in the weeds, but happens all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that, look, if you're going to be a member of Congress, you have to take all of the responsibilities that go along with that. And that means admitting when you do something wrong, and you have more of an incentive to change it.
I sort of look upon next year with some trepidation, I have to say. Not just for what the result might be, but how nasty it's going to be, I think. And whether, you know, civility can come back. Do you think that part of things?
I hope so.
Trump's, outrageous lack of civility can just be forgotten at some stage, if indeed he goes away, win or lose?
I want to just plead with as many people as possible to not let somebody else be the author of history. That you have, when somebody writes about you, what are they going to say? Are they going to say, this person did this because somebody else made them do it? I want to regain that power. I don't want to let the president or anybody else dictate how I behave to my fellow American or to my fellow human being. I want to be the author of my own history. And I hope, and if everyone takes that stance, then not one person will not have power over our history. We get to write it. We get to stand up and say, you're not going to write what our kids read about. We're going to write it.
Well, it is really, it's so good to meet you, and it's so great to have you here at Wheeler. I feel both even more troubled, of course.
No, there's hope. I said there's hope in people.
I'm a bit glass half empty when it comes to all things Trump. I'm a pessimist, and I'm happy to sort of stay lurking in that pessimism so that I can't be any more disappointed or mortified or scared than I already am. I think it's dangerous. I think our times are dangerous.
It is dangerous.
And he's dangerous. Yeah. And that's just where I'm stuck for now. However, meeting you, having you here is, with your experiences within this party that he outrageously claims an association with, I think is inspiring, and that is a good thing. It's a good thing for, worry warts like me.
I like to remind him that I've been a Republican longer than he has.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you really have.
And I'm much younger.
Well,
and I, you know, I will continue to watch your commentary. Of course, I'm sure we all will, with great interest, and all the best with it. Thank you again for coming here. I could just keep talking to you for hours, but it's been really great. Your candidness and just a delight. Mia Love, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you
all. For being kind.
Mia Love there, speaking with Sally Warhaft on Thursday the 17th of October, 2019, presented in partnership with the United States Study Centre at the University of Sydney. This series comes to you via the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for conversations about books, writing and ideas. Check us out at wheelercentre.com. Until next time, take care.